Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer, and it is my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. Along with Ted Vanita, who is serving as our worship associate, I am delighted to welcome you to this religious community. I would like to extend a special welcome to those of you who are with us for the first time this morning. We're always delighted to have guests at our services, and we hope that if you come again, you'll consider coming a bit early as we have our social hour between our first and second services beginning at approximately 10:30 a.m. If you find that you would like more information about the life and work of this community, I encourage you to complete a guest card, which you can find in the racks and the pews. You may place a completed card in the offering basket when it comes to you later in the service, or hand it to a representative of our membership committee who would be glad to greet you at the visitor's table just around the corner outside the sanctuary doors after the service. There you can also take a look at the collection in our church library if you'd like to find some books about Unitarian Universalism. Ours is a church that strives to practice the fragile art of hospitality. Often we take time to greet one another with a simple handshake during our morning services, but we've been experimenting this month with alternative ways to greet one another. This morning we're going to practice greeting with the Hindi greeting Namaste. Now, if you're not familiar with how to share this greeting, you place your hands together right in front of your heart, and then you simply bow your head. Namaste. I bow to you. Please take a moment to greet one another. In addition to asking you to silence your cell phones, I would like to direct your attention to the thread from the web. That is the insert in your order of service. There you will find several announcements as well as a calendar of events for the week ahead in the church. There are a few items that I would like to call to your attention. The political, satirical singer-songwriter Roy Zimmerman will be giving a concert at our church this Wednesday evening at 7:30 p.m. Roy Zimmerman played at the Kent stage last year as part of the Sing Out the Vote tour and was very well received. The suggested ticket price is $15, but no one will be turned away for lack of an ability to pay, so please spread the word and know that a portion of the proceeds from the concert will be donated to our congregation. The Sacred Conversation on Race, hosted by the First Congregational Church in Ravenna, will continue this afternoon at their church on South Chestnut Street at 5 p.m. Today, we will be viewing a portion of the powerful film, The Color of Fear. All are welcome. We have a full schedule of classes being offered at the church this year. If you haven't already looked at the pink brochure describing our groups and classes, there are more copies available on the table just outside the sanctuary doors where you got your order of service. Among the groups being offered are our Chalice Groups, which is our new name for our small group ministry program. Danny Beal has been both a participant in and a facilitator in our groups and has a word to say about her experience.
Hi, everybody. I have been in the Chalice Groups or small group ministry since the beginning at our church, and I want to talk a little bit about what that experience was for me when I first came to the church, because I came and I didn't know anybody, and it's difficult when you step into these social settings like coffee hour and don't know anybody in the room, knowing who to talk to. And one of the blessings that the groups has given me is that in any group that I go to within the Kent Church, I know someone there. Because I've been in these groups, now I feel like I kind of have spiderwebbed out, and I know somebody in any social situation. And for me, that's really helpful so that when I come in, I know at least one other soul there knows who I am. So that's one of the blessings that it has given me. And so I think it's really helpful for a new person in the church. And it's also wonderful to be with old friends. But when you're new, it's helpful to know a new face. Thanks.
If you have any interest in participating in our Chalice Groups this year, there is a table downstairs in Fessenden Hall. We'll be there after the service with someone who can answer your questions and take your registration forms. Elaine Bowen will be there. Next week, you're again invited to join us for worship at 9:30 and 11:15. Joel Slater and I will be leading the service together. Keeping with our month-long peace theme, the sermon next week is entitled Waging Peace in the Holy Land. All are welcome. At the end of today's service, Ted and I would be glad to greet you at the rear of the sanctuary. And once again, I bid you welcome. Sally Burnell will light our chalice.
Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart. And that was written by William Schultz, who was the student minister at this church a number of years ago.
Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside, study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. 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 Ain't gonna study war no more.
I'm gonna put on that long white robe down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna put on that long white robe
down by the riverside.
I'm gonna put on that starry crown down by the riverside.
Study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. 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 Ain't gonna study war.
Everybody, gonna lay down my sword and shield.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. I ain't gonna study.
For the past few weeks has been peace, which Melissa defined and discussed last Sunday. Since our service today is devoted to peace in our community, I thought it worthwhile to examine the word community. Melissa listed compassion as one of the four pillars of peace, and it struck me that the words compassion and community bear certain similarities. In the one case, we have a word meaning with passion, with love. And in the other, a word meaning with unity, with a sense of togetherness and common purpose. The two words don't always go together, but for me at least, the combination carries a very special meaning. When I was in the fifth grade, we moved from Pennsylvania to a small village in upstate New York. It was small, with a population of only 500. And there I found a community. It wasn't the village itself, but rather an even smaller community within the village. This community consisted of five boys who truly embodied a sense of togetherness and common purpose. For the next 7 years, we were a community. We were inseparable. We biked, we hiked, we argued and played together. We were five as one. We were a true community with both passion and with unity. Upon graduation from high school, we went our separate ways, and most of us never saw each other again. Now, I have known many groups of people since then and have made many close friends among them, in college, in the Army, in graduate school, as a university faculty member, and these have always been meaningful and special. But that small group of five youngsters back in Elbridge, New York, still represents what I would consider to be my own true community. The memories of that time have remained with me, and it's fair to say that in many ways, that tiny community was instrumental in molding me into the person I am, for better or for worse. Which brings me into the present moment at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent, where for the second time in my life, I feel that I have found a true community. This, as I mentioned earlier, is a very personal opinion, and I'm not suggesting that it means or should mean the same for each and every one of us. But for me, at least, it has been like coming home. I do feel a strong sense of community here, as well as a sense of peace. So there it is. It has all come together. I find peace in my community. And I would like to hope that it is the case for some of you as well. However that may be, I am taking this opportunity to wish you all peace in our community. May it be so. Come, let us worship together.
Good morning. I'm Karen Lapidus, and I'm the Director of Religious Education. I have a question for you. How many of you are curious people? Raise your hand if you're curious. So most of you, if not all of you, are curious. I'm curious, too, so I'm always finding myself asking why. Those standard why questions, why is the sky blue, and other questions like why are some people rich and some people poor? That's a question I ask a lot. And also the question that I ask a lot is why do we do the things that we do together in church? Earlier this week, Reverend Melissa told me that baby Silas Theol was going to be dedicated this morning during the 9:30 service. And I wondered if the children and the adults of this church knew why we dedicate babies and just what that means. Since now I know that so many of you are curious, I will tell you why you use dedicate their babies. So first I'll tell you what happened this morning, and then I'll tell you why it happened. So baby Silas and his family were here together. The whole family was here. Grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins. And they came and stood up here, the parents and the baby. And then the mother and the father made promises to Silas. And these were promises that they wrote to him. They promised to keep him close to his family. They promised to keep their home safe and happy. They promised to bring him to church all the time. They even promised to take him to Summer Institute every summer. And they promised to love him. And then his godparents came up, and his godparents are his aunt and uncle, and they have a special nurturing relationship with Silas. And they also made promises. They promised to help him to be a good person, and his uncle even promised to teach him all about football. And then Reverend Melissa took Silas into her arms, and they were standing near this table here. And she called his name out loud for everyone to hear. And she blessed him with earth, air, fire, and water, and then arose. And the earth that is in this container here is the earth that was collected during the ingathering, as was the water that he was blessed with. The air that he was blessed with was the gentle breath of Melissa blowing onto his face. And then the candle was there. And then he was given a rose, and you'll see the empty vase. And the rose was given to him so that his life will unfold in beauty. And then everyone in the congregation read that blessing that you'll see in your order of service. We're not going to read it this service since Silas isn't with us, but it was our promise to Silas. And as members of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent, we are always making promises to each other. Our principles are promises, our classroom covenants are promises, and this morning, this church made its first promise to Silas. So, as Unitarian Universalists, we dedicate our babies because we believe that life should be honored and blessed, and we share with the parents their hopes for their child. And together, we promise to do all that we can to nurture the spiritual development of all of our children. And now, my curious friends, you know why we dedicate babies.
And I invite you to join now in a guided meditation. I encourage you to put your feet on the floor and to let your hands rest in your laps. Close your eyes if you wish, or just soften your gaze and breathe deeply, letting peace flow into you. Let peace calm your troubled self. Help your needy self. Help your whole self to remember to listen fully and completely. Breathe and let peace flow around you until you move with peace and speak words of peace, knowing compassion and reflecting all the radiance of this moment. Breathe, letting peace flow through you and beyond you. Let peace be your guide, filling you with wisdom. Let it be the bridge that connects not just with people of goodwill, but also with people whose hearts are centered in their own needs and desires, with people who are not yet free to bring peace into their hearts. Keep breathing and let peace fill the room, fill the air, fill our town, fill our world. Let peace begin again right now, here, today. We ask this in the name of the power that dwells within us and beyond us, a power called by many names in many times and places, but whose universal name is love. How many of you saw the 1982 Academy Award-winning film Gandhi? So you may remember this scene. I had not seen the film and watched it recently and was particularly moved by the scene in which Gandhi was thrown off the train in South Africa for refusing to move from a first-class car. It happens exactly as he reports in his autobiography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth. Come along, you must go to the van compartment. But I have a first-class ticket. That doesn't matter. I tell you, you must go to the van compartment. I tell you, I was permitted to travel in this compartment at Durban, and I insist on going in it. No, you won't, said the official. You must leave this compartment, or else I shall have to call a police constable and push you out. Yes, you may. I refuse to go voluntarily. So the constable came, took Gandhi by the hand, and pushed him out onto the platform. His luggage was thrown out after him, and the train steamed away. By Gandhi's own account, that night spent shivering in a train station waiting room was one of the turning points that shaped the direction his life would take in the future. He could get on the next train back to India, or he could carry on to Pretoria, South Africa, knowing full well that he would face many more indignities if he chose to stay. But choose to stay he did, and he determined that he would do his best while he was there to root out the deep disease of color prejudice. He had many unfortunate opportunities to test his new conviction. On a stagecoach just a few days later, a white coach operator refused him a seat inside the coach, and then later, when he wanted the outdoor seat near the driver for himself, tried to relegate Gandhi to sitting on a sackcloth on the floorboard. When Gandhi refused, the driver beat him and tried to drag him down off the seat until other passengers intervened on his behalf. When he arrived in Johannesburg, Gandhi was too surprised to discover that he was not even allowed to book a room in a hotel. In a Durban courtroom, he was ordered by a magistrate to remove his turban. Gandhi refused to do this, and choosing instead to leave the court. Having become personally acquainted with the indignities and trials of the Indian people living in South Africa, Gandhi determined that he would learn all he could about their condition. He got to know as many Indians as he could and discovered that they were deprived of most every basic human right and that this deprivation was enshrined in law. Indians in South Africa at the time could not own property and were given opportunities to work in only the most menial, dangerous, and low-paying positions. They could not own land except in areas specifically set apart for them, and they were prohibited from walking on sidewalks or walking anywhere at all after 9 p.m. without a special permit. Gandhi decided that he would try to make a difference, and he used his training as a lawyer to work against a disenfranchisement bill being considered. But he soon discovered that he would need more than his legal skills if he hoped to defeat the bill. He had to inspire and equip the people, lead meetings, raise funds, manage a budget, write pamphlets, garner support from the British living in South Africa, and plan a trajectory for the campaign. In short, he had to learn the skills of a community organizer. Before beginning my preparation for this service, I really didn't know very much about Gandhi's formative and life-changing work in South Africa. Maybe like some of you, I thought about Gandhi as Mahatma, great soul, the extraordinary political and spiritual leader of the movement for Indian independence from the British. I put him in the same category as people like Jesus and the Buddha and Martin Luther King Jr., larger-than-life figures who lived extraordinary lives that changed the course of history forever. But like Jesus and the Buddha and King, Gandhi believed that we too could choose the path that he had chosen. You must be the change you want to see in the world, he said. That's a hard calling when we imagine ourselves living with the courage and conviction of revolutionaries and saints. But when we remember that even revolutionaries and saints had things to learn, had to begin somewhere, and had to struggle from time to time with real-world human trials and limitations, the impossible melts a bit, making room for a way to emerge. It matters how we frame the challenge to ourselves. It matters how we tell the stories about the ones who have made a difference. In this country, we often tell the story of Rosa Parks. But too often, the story tells only the tip of the truth. Rosa Parks was tired, we say, so she sat down and refused to be moved. That's true, but there is so much more to tell. Rosa Parks was not just tired, she was also politically savvy, strategically organized, and supported and equipped to make a difference. I like the way Paul Rogat Loeb tells it in his book. Before refusing to give up her bus seat, which was actually at the front of the black section, not in the white section, Parks had been active for 12 years in her local NAACP chapter and had recently served as its secretary. The summer before her arrest, she had attended a 10-day training session at Tennessee's Labor and Civil Rights Organizing School, the Highlander Center, where she'd met an older generation of civil rights activists and discussed the recent Supreme Court decision banning separate but equal schools. During this period of her involvement in education, Parks had become familiar with previous challenges to segregation. Another Montgomery bus boycott 50 years earlier successfully eased some restrictions. A bus boycott in Baton Rouge won limited gains 2 years before Parks was arrested. And the previous spring, a young Montgomery woman had also refused to move to the back of the bus, causing the NAACP to consider a legal challenge on her behalf until it turned out that she was unmarried and pregnant and therefore a poor symbol for the campaign, they decided. In short, Rosa Parks didn't make a spur-of-the-moment decision. She didn't single-handedly give birth to the civil rights effort, but was part of an existing movement for change at a time when success was very far from certain. We all know Parks' name and should be inspired by her courage, but few of us know about Montgomery NAACP leader E.D. Nixon, who served as one of Parks' mentors and first got Martin Luther King Jr. involved in the campaign. Nixon carried people's suitcases on the trains and was active in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the union founded by legendary civil rights activist A. Philip Randolph. He played a key role in the campaign. No one talks of him any more than they talk of Joanne Robinson, who taught nearby at an underfunded and segregated black college and whose Women's Political Council distributed the initial leaflets around the city following Parks' arrest. Without the often lonely work of people like Nixon, Randolph, and Robinson, Parks would likely never have taken her stand, and if she had, it likely never would have had the same impact. This in no way diminishes the importance and historical power of Parks' refusal to give up her seat, but it reminds us that this tremendously consequential act, along with everything that followed, depended on all of the humble and frustrating and slow work that Parks and others undertook earlier on. It also reminds us that Parks' initial step of getting involved with the NAACP in the first place was just as courageous and critical as the stand on the bus that all of us have heard about. The conventional portrayal suggests that social activists come out of nowhere to suddenly take dramatic stands. It implies that we act with the greatest impact when we act alone, at least initially. And that change occurs instantly, as opposed to building on a series of often invisible actions. The myth of Parks as lone activists reinforces a notion that anyone who takes a committed public stand, or at least an effective one, has to be a larger-than-life figure, someone with more time, energy, courage, vision, passion, knowledge than any normal person could ever possess. This belief pervades our society, in part because the media tends not to represent historical change as the work of ordinary people, step by step, which it almost always is. I was reminded of that truth again this past Thursday evening when I attended the annual iftar, or breaking of the fast dinner, at the Islamic Society of Akron and Kent. The mosque holds this event each Ramadan as a way to build bridges and to educate the local community about Islam. My partner Ellen and I were seated with another couple, an older African-American Muslim couple. We talked throughout the evening with Sister Aisha, who told us about her conversion to Islam when she was 16 and her experience living life as an African-American Muslim. "Things have gotten harder in recent years," she told us. "I never thought I'd see the kind of struggle we saw when we were fighting for civil rights. But discrimination is more prevalent against Muslims now and out in the open." Lately, she told us, the focus has been on headscarves. She herself has been asked and has refused on several occasions to take off her scarf while in the bank. Some of her friends have been asked to take off their headscarves while trying to get a renewed driver's license at the DMV. Sister Aisha makes it a point to tell her Muslim sisters that they are not required to comply with these requests. She makes it a point to let them know that they are protected by Ohio law. I tell these stories at length because I believe the aphorism made famous by Pope Paul VI, "If you want peace, work for justice." As we consider how to do the work of peacemaking in our communities, we have to consider the demands of justice. This is a foundational theological principle for a Unitarian Universalist approach to peacemaking, and it is reflected in our peacemaking statement of conscience that Mac Eckler and other members of the peacemaking core team worked so hard to bring before the delegates to the General Assembly this year. Peace is an attribute of relationship. It's a process, not a stagnant state. Peace emerges as our social and political institutions become more cooperative and more just. Lasting peace rests on just relationships. This is fundamental to the approach the United Nations has taken in defining the values, attitudes, and behaviors that reject violence, prevent conflict, and support a culture of peace. Peace requires access to quality education, including education in conflict resolution, consensus building, and active nonviolence. Peace requires sustainable economic and social development for all people. It requires respect for human rights and equality between men and women. Peace requires the assurance of security. Peace requires understanding, tolerance, and solidarity. The ability to see ourselves as brothers and sisters, no matter how strong our disagreements. That's why I chose Namaste as our greeting today. Though in its simplest translation, Namaste means I bow to you, it is most often spiritually translated to mean the divine in me bows before the divine in you. The divine spark in me recognizes the divine spark in you. The light in me sees the light in you. Namaste. It's a Hindi gesture, greeting, meditation, but it has great resonance for Unitarian Universalists. The divine spark in me recognizes the divine spark in you. Even when we disagree, you are still my brother. I am still your sister. This clearly has implications for the resolution of interpersonal conflicts, but I think it also has relevance for conflicts on the scale of community. I see it in some of the secular anti-bullying literature and resources that have been made widely available in recent years. A great deal of the anti-bullying focus has been on the bystander. The bystanders are the kids who see some harm being done in front of them, but don't know what to do. Too often, bystanders remain silent and fail to intervene to stop the harm they are witnessing. Maybe they're afraid, maybe they don't want to see what's happening, or maybe just are not equipped to act. Those who teach kids to deal with bullying remind them that when bystanders are silent, their silence is most often interpreted by the bully as assent. Kids can make a difference, they tell them, by remembering the word nice. Notice that something is happening. Interpret if the situation is one in which help is needed. Choose how to act and engage with the problem. What's true for kids is also true for adults. When a conflict begins brewing in one of our communities, some serious disagreement or justice, injustice, or bullying writ large, we can notice what is happening. First, we must notice. Then we can interpret the situation to see if it's one in which help is needed to diffuse the conflict. We can choose how to act for help and engage with the problem. That's what Gandhi did. That's what Rosa Parks did. That's what Sister Aisha is doing. That's what we can do too. The step we take may be just a very small step in a very long road to peace, but we will never get to peace unless we take that step. Namaste. For all who see God, may God go with you. For all who embrace life, may life return your embrace. For all who seek a right path, may a way be found and the courage to take it step by step. Go in peace.